Coming up today, sunspots, undersea cables, Richard Dawkins on no platforming, and a very special message from Stephen Hawking. You're listening to episode 274 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
And Matt Burgess.
Good day.
A thing you learnt this week, Matt Burgess.
I've learnt this week that the Robot World Cup has kicked off in Germany.
Robots? Playing football?
Yeah, they're better than the England squad, which wouldn't actually be that hard.
Well, hey.
Yeah, had to get that one in there. And they're basically loads of different sides of robots, some humanoid robots, some little things that look like more like remote control cars, kicking balls around and scoring goals.
And I'm sure we'll report on some of the more terrifying and hilarious outcomes of that on Wired UK next week. Matt Reynolds, what did you learn?
So Madison Bumgarner is an American baseball player. He plays for the San Francisco Giants. What was the name of his high school girlfriend? It was also Madison Bumgarner. What are the chances? Two people dating exactly the same name.
With quite unusual names as well.
Yeah, exactly. And no relation, he, you know, assured us. So,
well, there we go. I learnt this year that every year NASA detects 200 previously unknown objects in orbit around the Earth. So it turns out it's a really busy place up there. And I'm presuming this is things that have started to break up, so one object becomes two, becomes three, becomes four. Lots of stuff smashing into each other bits of stuff up there. So, yeah, there's that. It's very busy up in space. Matt Burgess, our first story this week is about undersea cables. And a very big one was launched, opened this week.
Yeah, in service is the correct word. But just to recap on what undersea cables are for people that don't know, they are basically submarine cables that are laid across the seabed between different countries, connecting one place to another and providing an internet connection between A and B.
Okay.
And so, basically, there are more than 100 of these around the world going across, under all the oceans. The brand new one just been open connecting the US and Japan this week.
And there's an interesting big headline company that's involved in this.
Yeah, so Google, one of the main companies behind this new cable. It's called the Google Faster Cable, and it carries 60 terabytes of data per second. It's the highest capacity and fastest undersea cable in the world. It's cost them $300 million, which is about £222.
And £222 million.
£222 million. And was created after a partnership between six different companies, including China Mobile, China Telecom, Global Transit, KDDI, Singtel, and NEC Corporation, which actually laid the cable.
Okay, and just to rewind a little bit, these cables are very much the backbone of the internet. There's no way of getting an internet connection between the US and Europe without them. You can't get an internet connection between Russia and the United States. They are absolutely key to, they're the backbone of the internet.
Yeah, they are. And every continent in the world is connected via these cables, except for Antarctica, which all the internet, all phones, all video, all email traffic that comes to the country, it has to be provided by a satellite connections.
Which is kind of understandable when most of your population are penguins.
Yeah, that is true. But these cables, they're mostly physical cables. They're all physical cables that carry data from one place to another. And it's mostly public data, so mostly internet data that we're using every day.
Okay, so give me a fact. The longest subsea cable in the world, because this is kind of remarkable.
So the longest subsea cable is the Southeast Asia, Middle East, Western Europe 3. It's a really catchy name, but it's 39,000 kilometers long, which is roughly about 24,000 miles, and connects everywhere from southern Australia to the Netherlands. So it runs all the way through all the oceans between there, past Africa, up to the Netherlands, and it's got 39 different connection points where it's docking on land.
So who is actually laying these cables?
So Google has been involved with this cable. They've got five other different cables. But the cables themselves have got quite a long history. So the first subsea Atlantic cable was laid in 1865 and was used to send what are they called? I forgot what they're called.
Telegrams.
Telegram messages from across the Atlantic. So nowadays, there's a lot of big companies laying them. So Google have done these. They've got five others. Microsoft and Facebook announced a new cable earlier this year. And that cable is going to connect Virginia to Bilbao and is going to be 6,000 kilometers long. And basically, it's marking a bit of a shift between these cables carrying really public internet data to companies actually sending their own data.
Which for Google is huge when you own things like YouTube or Facebook, when you're trying to really push video, making sure that you can very, very quickly send very bandwidth heavy content, as we call it, around the world at the speed of light. It's incredibly important. So these direct connections. And there's another side to this as well, and this isn't the reason for Google building this cable necessarily, but privacy issues. In the wake of the NSA revelations, Brazil has started to develop the idea of building a cable that will link it to the rest of the world without having to go through the United States, because where the data goes on these cables before it gets to you is also a really big issue.
It is. And with that Brazil case, I think one of the things that they're doing there is they're not going to use any parts that are made in the US, which is obviously down to NSA stuff. But also there's an issue of, because these companies are building their own cables now, they're sending their own data. That could be to get around different privacy laws. So in Europe, there was a big deal called Safe Harbor between Europe and the US, which saw data being sent from Facebook's Irish offices across to the US, and this data was being intercepted by whoever could actually physically access these cables when they come into land. And this data sharing agreement was actually struck down by a European court last year, and has a big impact for business. And actually there's been negotiation going on to recreate a different deal where data is sent across these cables in a way that is compliant with privacy laws.
There's also a democratization of data and internet infrastructure thing going on here. And again, this isn't maybe why Google, one of the world's most valuable companies, built a cable. But let's think about it. A cable that links Virginia and Bilbao. Okay, they're two Western developed nations. But what about a cable that links sub-Saharan Africa to South America? This is what Brazil is working on. Or a cable that connects Southeast Asia to Australia. Different countries that need stronger connections and don't want to rely on passing through traditional hubs of power such as Amsterdam or the United States or Dublin or London. So it's the more and more cables that we get under the sea, the more free potentially information is going to be, which can only be a good thing.
It can. And as we see more of these cables coming, there's going to be more data being shared across places. We are creating more data and sending more information than ever. So to keep up with the internet speeds that we're used to and to get faster speeds, we do need more of these cables. And it is still, I think, quite crazy that our internet is all literally physically connected across the whole world. And if you were to break one of these cables, then it would stop the internet from running.
Which is why sharks and anchors are a problem, apparently, which is kind of fun. Matt Reynolds, our second story this week is all about sunspots, or a lack thereof. Tell us some more.
Absolutely. So for the second time within the last month, the sun has looked completely blank, not a single sunspot. So if you've seen a picture of the sun, it's often dotted by little darker patches, and that's what sunspots are. There can be dozens or, you know, even hundreds of those at a time, but right now there's not one single sunspot on the surface of the sun.
So this means we're all going to die, the sun's going to stop working, it's the end of life as we know it.
Yeah, just give up, it's completely over.
Fantastic.
No, that's not quite what it means. In fact, what it means is that the sun is approaching its solar minimum. So basically, the sun goes through these like 11-year cycles where it produces its solar maximum. It produces loads and loads and loads of sunspots. Sometimes you might have as many as 200 at one time. And that is solar minimum, which we're heading towards and we'll hit in about 2020. It produces hardly any at all for quite long periods of time.
So it's almost as if the sun, you call them cycles, it's almost as if it has seasons. The sun isn't fixed.
Yeah, exactly. So these very kind of very long seasons of 11 years, and scientists aren't really sure why that actually is.
And I'm actually not sure what sunspots are. Do you know any more about them?
Okay, cool. So what sunspots look like, they look like dark patches on the sun, and essentially they're just little bits of the sun's surface that are much cooler than the surrounding areas. So the sun is really hot, about 5,500, 6,000 degrees Kelvin. Sunspots are about 2,000 degrees Kelvin, less than that. these sunspots, you know, they look tiny if you look at them, you know, when you're looking at the sun, they're huge. You know, some of them are tens of thousands of miles in diameter. You know, that's bigger than Jupiter. And the reason why these sunspots happen is, you know, unlike the Earth, which is a rock and, you know, one part of the Earth rotates the same speed as another part of the Earth, because the sun is made of gases of different densities, different parts of the Earth, of the sun, sorry, whether you're at the equator or at one of the poles, rotate at different speeds. And that basically messes up all these magnetic fields that twist and turn and then create these ultra bunched up magnetic field areas, which appears as a sunspot.
And sunspots, because they're such violent places of activity, the areas around the edge can release radiation into the solar system, which is why we get the Northern Lights and also why we have potentially problems with satellites being knocked out and astronauts getting very badly damaged by hugely charged radiation particles being ejected by the sun. They're solar flares, coronas.
Yeah, that's right. So, and that's the reason why this solar blank phase does have something to do with this on Earth. So basically, like you said, James, when we've got a lot of solar activity with these solar maximum phases, loads and loads of solar flares and solar storms chuck off loads of radiation, and some of that hits the Earth atmosphere, bounces off. But some of that, if you're, say, a pilot that flies over the Antarctica or the Arctic, or you're an astronaut, it might hit you. So higher periods of solar activity are associated with more radiation. But this blank period is bad in a different way.
Okay.
So that solar storms and all those solar flares and stuff, that creates a kind of solar shield that deflects a different type of radiation that are called galactic cosmic rays. And this is background radiation that comes from exploding stars from the beginning of the universe. It's really kind of cool, very, very ancient stuff. Those solar flares tend to deflect that from the Earth. When we've got a very inactive period like we're having now, much more of that radiation can kind of reach Earth, and it leaves astronauts, especially ones that might be having longer missions in orbit, you know, leaves them much more vulnerable to radiation.
So as astronauts embark on missions to Mars over the next couple of decades, which is what a lot of people hope will happen, they could be at a higher risk of radiation from the early universe or from exploding stars that are very far away because the sun isn't there to watch their backs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, astronauts are one of the highest risk occupations for getting radiation-induced cancer. So really trying to create, you know, something that can shield us from this radiation is a really big deal for working out how we can get to Mars. Because, I mean, you know, the journey to Mars takes something like 900 days. It's a real big problem, that exposure you've got over that time.
Yeah, and they're still trying to come up with ways of making it much safer so that when astronauts do get to Mars, they're in pretty good shape and not half dead. Matt Burgess, Tesla. There's been some very, very sad news this week to do with its autopilot feature. First of all, very briefly explain what autopilot is and what's happened.
Okay, so just the quick one line, what's happened is a case of a man who was driving his Tesla car, which is an electric car in the US, in Florida, and using the autopilot mode, which is a semi-autonomous mode of driving, was killed in an accident. And this is believed to be the first case where a person in a car which has capabilities to be self-driving has been killed.
And so the man is Joshua David Brown, 40 years old, from Ohio, and he died whilst driving along Route 27 on the 7th of May. Really, really sad news. But as you say, it's a first case. So what went wrong with the technology?
So to explain the technology, it is this autopilot feature is was introduced in October 2015 for certain types of Tesla models, and it is a semi-autonomous way of driving. It isn't the sort of the same way autonomous self-driving cars that Google has and other people are developing. It's the first sort of step towards this, and it actually, autopilot allows supported cars to steer themselves on motorways, change lanes with a flick of the indicator, so if you press it down it will move across into a lane when it's free, and to help the car know where it is, there are, there's a forward-looking radar, a forward-looking camera, 12 long-range ultrasonic sensors positioned to sense basically 16 feet all the way around the car. So the mode is a way of looking at what's around the car and actually controlling it itself. And at the moment, it's actually in a beta stage.
Yeah, and this is, just to stop you there, this is the interesting thing, to think that a car can have a feature that is still in beta, and now that feature has potentially, it seems, led to someone losing their life. So we're getting into really uncharted territory here.
Yeah, it really is. And Tesla have actually said that because it is still in beta, this is a feature that they say drivers have to turn on. It's not automatically turned on. They have to make it actually activate it themselves. And they also are supposed to keep their hands on the wheel at all times and be alert as they were driving a car. I mean, that in individual circumstances, and I'm not saying in this one in particular this happened, but there are videos online where people are taking their hands off the wheel, where they're looking out the window, where they're doing different things, all at different speeds, really.
Yeah, and just briefly to go back to the technology, specifically in this accident, what happened that fooled or confused the autopilot mode?
So the autopilot mode, and this is in Tesla's words, neither the autopilot mode nor the driver noticed the white side of the tractor trailer against a brightly lit sky, so the brake was not applied. Basically, because this trailer or the truck that this car hit was the same colour as the sky, the sensors didn't really see it, they couldn't really understand that it was there, is the sort of explanation which Tesla are doing. The US highways authorities are actually looking at the case now, and they're going to look at the conduct an investigation into whether the technology worked properly and all these things. And that has not been like prejudiced. That's not been decided that yes, this is the autopilot's fault or it's the driver's fault or anything like that, but this is the first case of this happening.
Yeah, and just to finish Tesla's statement, because I think it's quite interesting and insightful, the company continued, the high ride height of the trailer combined with its positioning across the road and the extremely rare circumstances of the impact caused the Model S to pass under the trailer, with the bottom of the trailer impacting on the windshield of the Model S. So a very unfortunate incident and a real test for the technology and for regulators, it seems to me anyway.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking, what kind of legal framework exists around this, and you know, does that need to be put in place to deal with autonomous cars, and you know, where the liability lies in this case?
Yeah, that's what is particularly interesting, although this is obviously a very tragic case. There is an interesting element behind this because it's starting to bring out the questions of who is responsible in a case like this. Is it Tesla? Is it the drivers? Is it the autopilot's fault? Or... but yeah, whose is it? We don't know. That is one of the big questions being raised by this. But also there are issues around regulations for this sort of technology, because different countries have different regulations. The US is developing regulations. The UK has got slightly more set out regulations around self-driving cars.
And even in the US, it varies by state.
Yeah, it does. And there is no, particularly for the US, this is going to be a big thing in terms of looking at the regulations of what driverless cars can do and where the responsibilities lie. It is a difficult case that is going to be one that obviously progresses and discusses, but this sort of thing is obviously very tragic to have happened
and utterly untested. So we'll be keeping an eye on it, and we'll see what comes out of the investigation and how Tesla continues to respond. In January of this year, Richard Dawkins, the author of The Selfish Gene and The God Delusion, was no platform by the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, or NECSS. The organisers took issue with what they described as a retweet of a highly offensive video that Dawkins later deleted. Dawkins was eventually replatformed by the organisation, but was unable to attend due to ill health. Earlier this week, I sat down with Richard Dawkins at the Starmus Astrophysics Conference and asked him for his views on no platforming.
I'm very disturbed by it because it's mostly universities that do it, and universities of all places, the places where we should value freedom of speech. I was in Berkeley in the 1960s, shortly after the free speech movement, and it distresses me very much that in Berkeley, of all places, we've had people no platform. This is going flat against the principle of free speech. And the other thing is that it's so babyish. It's sort of fussing about whether somebody's feelings might be hurt. If you're that much of a sensitive flower, you shouldn't be at university at all. University is a place where you learn new ideas, ideas that challenge you, ideas that may even scare you.
So he's clearly quite annoyed by it and puts forward quite a powerful argument against it. But I wonder straight away what your responses are to what Dawkins has had to say. Matt Reynolds.
I guess, you know, I wouldn't necessarily have thought I would have said this, but I kind of feel myself broadly agreeing with Dawkins here. I kind of think that you should give anyone the opportunity to express their views, you know, and it's up to individuals to decide how they interpret those. You know, hopefully you'd expect reasonable people to, you know, dismiss people that are like, you know, expelling hatred, or, you know, they're just kind of plain silly. But I think that's probably a decision for the individual watching it to make, and not some authority to say, no, you don't get to listen to this because they're not suitable to be listened to.
Mm, and there's a line to be drawn here between hate speech and what is hate speech, and how broadly do we define it? And this is hugely controversial, and I don't particularly want to get into that. But just to take a step back, broadly, no platforming has grown in popularity in recent years. It's now recognised by the UK's National Union of Students. In the case of the NUS, it has been used to deny certain people, organisations, etc., a platform to speak. So in the UK, the British National Party and the English Defence League, both are seen as neo-Nazi or fascist organisations. They are banned from speaking at any NUS-affiliated institutions or events, and also NUS employees and officers are not allowed to take to the stage with these people. The practice has proven controversial, with some right-wing media outlets overstating its use. Both Boris Johnson and Jermaine Greer were reportedly no-platformed, but those reports were somewhat wide of the mark, and they were actually platformed and allowed to have their say in front of students at universities. Matt Burgess, what do you think?
It is an incredibly complex issue, I think. With no platforming, it depends on who the event is, I think, as well. We're obviously talking quite in the context of universities and the NUS in these cases, but I think that those people running the events have to decide who they're inviting, who they're having, what people could be saying at their events, and that may differ if it's a university or a public conference that's going on, because I've heard of conferences being cancelled because of potentially radical speakers being asked or invited and attend. And these sort of things, yeah, there is a line that you have to draw between where we as a society say, this is what you're saying is unlawful, it's going to be hateful to somebody, it's going to be damaging, it's going to upset them, it's going to provoke anger. And that is something that is difficult to do because we all have different beliefs and different moral standards.
But as Dawkins says, are we being sensitive flowers here, or is there a really important idea of how's the way to put it? And his idea is that people should be able to say what they want, seemingly, and that not wanting to hear that makes you a sensitive flower. But there are certain things that mean that people shouldn't be given a platform. If you are a member of the British National Party, then arguably you shouldn't be given a platform. Famously, the BBC did give Nick Griffin, the leader of the British National Party, at one point a platform on primetime television, and the party collapsed as a result. Once people heard what he had to say, they had the intelligence to realise that it was vulgar. And so him being platformed ultimately led to his demise, right?
Yeah, and I think that the thing is, it's not like someone potentially being platformed means they're going to speak everywhere. You know, Nick Griffin's not being invited to the Chelsea Flower Show. It's not like saying, if we don't mandate your attendance, that people are just going to spring up and speak anyway. So I think, obviously, common sense dictates that you pick your speakers carefully for your audience. You make them appropriate. But I think exactly what you said, James, having a kind of culture of mature debate is really helpful for actually bringing these people, you know, giving them prominence, but also bringing them down. And I think unless we, you know, weed these people out and really, you know, expose ignorance, if that's what it is, the only way it gets out there is by being exposed to people that are going to have that back and forth. So I think it's really important that we have a kind of dialogue and we don't blanket say, you don't get to talk here, full stop. I think that could be kind of dangerous, really.
Yeah. To go back to the NUS and how it defines no platforming. So it says that individuals or members of organisations or groups identified by the NUS's Democratic Procedures Committee as holding racist or fascist views may not stand for election for any NUS position or attend any NUS function or conference. And NUS employees, officers are also, as I said, not allowed to speak alongside them. So it isn't just some vague idea of denying certain people a platform to speak. It's written down. It is a process that organizations are going through, and it's spreading. As Dawkins was no platformed and then re-platformed from an event in New York, this isn't just something that's limited to the National Union of Students. And it's interesting as well, and Dawkins didn't want to speak to me about this, he got no platformed and then replatformed for something that he posted on Twitter. And this is a separate part of this problem is social media and how it can often polarise debate, shall we say?
Yeah, I think that's the thing that I... Often when something gets on Twitter, and if people get hold of it on Twitter, you can have tens of thousands of people weighing in and saying, this is the worst thing ever. I think what people have to remember is that Twitter isn't necessarily representative of the views that people hold in a country or in a society as a whole, but it is a really telling gauge of whether what you're saying is okay.
And so, it should be said that the post that Dawkins posted and deleted, a retweet of a video, it was offensive and was widely condemned, and it's telling that he deleted it. And there's this instant ability to offend an awful lot of people, and then that can have repercussions of being no platformed or widely derided. And that wasn't a thing before.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what's interesting about that is that, you know, the NUS says, you know, people that hold racist or fascist views. Well, it's interesting that, say, Richard Dawkins gets no platform because you post one video and that shows that you hold racist or fascist views. It's, you know, it's, although you said that it is clear enough on paper, but the line is kind of difficult. You know, are you fascist if you say one thing one time, you do one retweet, and then the rest of the time you don't say that? Or, you know, other people really consistently hold horrible views. And I think it's interesting because people are deciding these limitations, and it is really quite nuanced and really open to interpretation.
Yeah, no platforming has been put forward as quite a recent phenomenon, but it goes back further than that. And there's also an interesting sort of state level no platforming. So the Dutch MP Geert Wilders, who's the leader of the neo-fascist Freedom Party, was denied entry to the UK by the Home Office on the grounds that he was a risk, that he was, his views were so extreme and so offensive that he should not be allowed into this country. So there's a whole different level of that.
Yeah, and I think, well, with that particular case, that is the decision that's been made basically on the grounds that, based on the law, that's a case if you are going to incite hatred or things like that, then there is a more of a legal definition of this. But wider, I'd say those of us that are living in democratic societies, which thankfully everybody in the UK does, I think we are need to have the ability to have a freedom of speech. People need to be able to speak freely and be challenged on their views, be able to actually change their opinions, because that's how people do change their opinions if they're open-minded and want to. Healthy debate makes the society better, and by saying that no, you can't have a platform to say your views and your opinions, which, if based around the law, if they're unlawful, yes, okay, I can see that being a fair position. If you're going to be breaking laws or inciting hatred, then yes, we can say you shouldn't be speaking on these issues. But to move society on and to keep society being democratic, we need to have open debate and conversations between as many people as possible.
Yeah, but to come back on that, as an organiser of a conference, it's my prerogative who I invite to speak. But this is where no platform becomes quite different, because it is deliberately going out of your way to say, not that person. That person shouldn't speak. So I can see it from both sides. If I'm organising an event, why would I want to invite someone to speak on a topic, even if they might be relevant, if I think what they have to say and things that they have said in the past makes them inappropriate to speak? So it's interesting. It's a really difficult thing to weigh up. And I wonder what everyone else out there thinks. You can let us know. Probably best to do it on Twitter. Keep it to 140 characters, or maybe send it as a direct message. We're at YGK on Twitter, or personally, I'm at Jay Temperton.
I'm Matt at Matt S. Reynolds 1.
And I'm at Matt Burgess 1.
And from Dawkins to Hawking, I want to finish the show on a somewhat inspiring note. In fact, a completely inspiring note. As I said earlier this week, I was at the Starmus Astrophysics Conference in Tenerife. This year's event was a celebration of the life of Stephen Hawking, with guests including Chris Hadfield, Carolyn Porco, Alexei Leonov, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Brian May, Martin Rees. I could go on. Really stellar lineup of speakers. But the highlight of the event was a speech by Hawking himself, entitled A Brief History of Mine. Here's how it ended, and we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
It has been a glorious time to be alive and doing research in theoretical physics. Our picture of the universe has changed a great deal in the last 50 years, and I'm happy if I have made a small contribution. The fact that we humans, who who are ourselves mere collections of fundamental particles of nature, have been able to come this close to an understanding of the laws governing us and our universe, it's a great triumph. I want to share my excitement and enthusiasm about this quest. So remember to look up at the stars and not down at your feet. Try to make sense of what you see, and wonder about what makes the universe exist. Be curious. And however difficult life may seem, there is always something you can do, and succeed at. It matters that you don't just give up.